Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, New Books in History. I'm your host, R. Grant Kleiser. With me today is Dr. Juan Jose Ponce Vasquez, who is an assistant professor of history at the University of Alabama. He is a specialist in colonial Latin American history, the Spanish Caribbean, and the Spanish Atlantic, especially during the 17th century. After many years of writing and research related to Hispano-French interactions on the island of Hispaniola, the infamous depopulations of the island, which we will talk much more about in this interview, and smuggling activities by various people in Santo Domingo, he has just released his first book entitled Islanders and Empire, Smuggling and Political Defiance in Hispaniola, 1580 to 1690. Islanders and Empire tracks the importance of smuggling to the society, economy, and politics of the island of Hispaniola in this long 17th century. Smuggling, in his words, made people's lives on the island. An island that had suffered from imperial commercial neglect and a declining sugar industry. Concomitant with this endemic smuggling, local elites began asserting their control over local and imperial institutions on the island, taking advantage of royal officials' isolation from the Spanish metropole and their need for local alliances. These factors, Dr. Ponce Vasquez argues, allowed local elites to gain immense wealth and power, alter the course of European inter-imperial struggles, limit, redirect, and suppress the Spanish crown's policies, and thus take control of the destinies of Hispaniola, other Spanish Caribbean territories, and the Spanish Empire in the region during this period. Many thanks, Dr. Ponce Vasquez, for taking the time to speak with me today, and a big congratulations on this great monograph.
Thank you, Grant. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So first off, I'm just a little bit curious to ask, what got you interested in this particular time, place, and subject?
Well, this project started in grad school for me, so I'm sure you can relate to those early stages. And I really wanted to work on Spanish Caribbean, and I was trying to kind of figure out what that was going to be. I realized it was this enormous hole in the historiography when it came to the insular Spanish Caribbean and about anything that is not actually Cuba. it's Cuba and Havana, right? That's kind of like reigns over the historiography quite strongly. But there is, in terms of the insular Spanish Caribbean, there is very little for Hispaniola, particularly in the 17th century. There is a bit in the 16th century, that's quite a bit, and the 18th century as well. But then it seems that there is kind of this hole in the middle and that doesn't connect the 16th and 18th century. And I felt compelled to actually try to figure out what's happening in this at this point, right? So that drove me straight into a place that kind of has been neglected also by the historiography, not only by the Spanish Empire during this time.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, because this is such an unfamiliar topic to so many people, could you just describe briefly what the political and economic situation of Hispaniola was around 1580 when your monograph starts? So, and in particular, why did residents choose to smuggle so extensively, and what exactly were they smuggling?
Yeah, so I tried in the first chapter, I tried precisely to kind of like get people up to speed on that 16th century, like from 1492 to kind of 1580s, right? So by 1580s, what is happening is, as you mentioned actually in your introduction, there are at least three things happening, right? So there is the crisis of the plantation economy on the island, which is becoming quite important by the 1550s, 1560s. It starts to actually be clear that it's on a decline. And it has to do both with internal and external factors. Internally, the island, the quality of the sugar on the island is not, it's not high quality, right? And so that also makes the price to go down. And then you have also competition from other places in the Atlantic that are starting to produce sugar of higher quality and in higher volumes, like Brazil, right? This is the moment that Brazil starts producing sugar. So Hispaniola's sugar becomes kind of like a secondary in the market, and people start looking for alternatives, right? For alternative to sugar plantations. And they're going to experiment with ginger. Ginger becomes quite important in the last decades of the 16th century for Hispaniola and for other places in the Caribbean, like Puerto Rico as well. So ginger becomes kind of like a possible substitute, but it never really, it never becomes like the only thing, because hides during all this time, the cattle economy is being always very important, and it's going to continue to be important all the way till the 18th century, pretty much until the end of the 18th century. Cattle is going to be the defining kind of economic exploit of the island, right? Also for smuggling, as I'll say in a minute. So the crisis of plantation economy is one thing. The other one is, as you also mentioned, the Hispaniola is left outside of Spanish mercantile networks. During the second half of the 16th century, Spain is starting to organize the fleet system that actually, you know, this monopoly system in which Spain sends goods, manufactured goods to the colonies in two fleets yearly, and in exchange of silver and other products, kind of like that they establish this monopoly that works and doesn't work at the same time, but you know it fulfills his role to actually direct cash to the Spanish coffers. Hispaniola is left outside of that circuit. So even though Santo Domingo is kind of the main port of the Americas, really until almost until the 1520s and 30s, it's kind of like the place, right? After that, it starts slowly starts kind of being outside of these networks. And that's going to be, you know, it's very hard to get European products in Hispaniola, particularly, and this is what they are smuggling. They are smuggling for cloth and clothing accessories, and also enslave Africans. And they're exchanging them normally for hides, but also sometimes ginger and sugar.
Yeah, it's really interesting kind of connecting those last two points that you made, that the historiography until recent years has kind of followed the flota system in certain ways, that Cuba, Havana is the major center of Caribbean, Spanish Caribbean studies, and you know, that kind of became one of the major ports of stopovers for the flota system. So you know, describing this alternate this world that is kind of left on the outside of the flota system is a big
and Cartagena thing. Too. Cartagena is the other place, right? Havana and Cartagena are like the two places, probably the best known places for the Spanish Caribbean, precisely because of their connections with the flotas and slavery and the slave trade, right?
Yeah, definitely. So speaking about smuggling, a key phrase you use in your book is, quote, the moral economy of smuggling, that historian Jesse Cromwell uses in his recent book, The Smuggler's World, which is about 18th century smuggling in what is now Venezuela, and was inspired by the work of E.P. Thompson. Can you describe what you mean by this moral economy of smuggling that developed?
Yeah, I'm very happy that actually Jesse coined this term, because it kind of like it saved me the trouble to actually to have it to do the heavy lifting in this case. So this idea that Jesse kind of coins for Venezuela, and in many ways it takes shape throughout the 17th century, and by the 18th century it's kind of fully formed in Jesse's work. For me, it's kind of like similar in that sense, but it starts even earlier, right? So Hispaniola residents believe that the participation in the contraband trade was an inherent right, right? Despite the crown's opposition and the attempts to stifle this trade, right? So people from all kinds of backgrounds, or all social backgrounds, participated in it. And we're talking about church, members of the church, royal administration, local elites, free people of color, enslaved people also through their masters are sometimes forced to participate in this. So there is this, there are possibly Maroons as well, although this we have actually less information. So people embrace this smuggling as facing the lack of support from the crown. So many people, particularly in rural parts of Hispaniola, they're going to oppose any attempts to stop them very fiercely and sometimes violently. Right. So it becomes I think it's important to remember also that there is sort of always for some people it's an inherent right and they do this openly. For others, they still believe in inherent right, but they understand very much that actually the crown opposes it, so that they engage in a process of dissimulation. Right. For example, they voice their concern about contraband to the crown, but at the same time, they are participating. And this happens also in the Audiencia. It happens with a lot of people who are actually, they know the language that the crown wants to hear, and they actually play to their audience, right? But in reality, they're also participating.
Yeah, definitely. And, and as you say this, this becomes an endemic part of the culture of the island. So, connecting back and talking about the reasons for this smuggling activity and being left out of the flotas system. Another term you employ in this book is periphery. And many historians have labeled Hispaniola as a periphery after the first decades of Spanish conquest and colonization. And as this process happens of being kind of left out of this major commercial network for the Spanish. But in your analysis, would you consider Hispaniola a periphery?
I think it certainly is, but there are some caveats, I think, to the use of the term. I'd like to mention two now, right? The first one is, I'm a big fan of a center-periphery model. I think it's helpful, but at the same time, it can be dangerous as well, right? In many ways, when thinking about the Spanish Empire, centers are very, very few, and peripheries are many, right? So in many ways, the normative character of the Spanish Empire is periphery, it's not center, right? So that's very important to remember, that the center is not the norm, it's the exception, right? So that's one thing. The second one is that periphery as a category is not an absolute, right? Places are not either or. Places are not either centers or periphery, but depending on what you're looking at, there can be several things at the same time, right? So, for example, in the case of Hispaniola, it is politically, it's a center for the Caribbean, right? Because the Audiencia is there, the High Court of Appeals is there, which means that people have to constantly kind of go back and forth, and they present their cases to the Audiencia, they appeal to the Audiencia, so they're traveling in and out. And this is something, obviously, that local elites, this is one of the points I'm trying to make in the book, that local elites are going to hold on to this and take advantage of this, right, for their own ends. But at the same time, as we discussed already, commercially, it is at least commercially within the Spanish Empire, it is a periphery. But commercially, in the Atlantic sense, actually, it becomes a very important place, right? So in that sense, it could be actually a center or a center of sorts, right? And then there is one more thing that I think it's also crucial, which is that periphery is not a synonym of less importance, which is sometimes the way that we have used it as historians. I think sometimes historians have kind of followed, using these terms have followed actually the interests of the Spanish Empire, for example. We use this term in many ways the way that actually the empires use them, right? So because the priorities for, in the case of the Spanish Empire, is actually that the silver that comes from northern Mexico and the Andes, you know, everything else is periphery. The important thing is to secure those, right? But that doesn't mean that the peripheries are unimportant. At least as a historian, we need to kind of like remove ourselves from that categorization and think of peripheries as crucial parts of the empire, that if these ones fall, everything will fall as a domino effect, right? Yeah. So we need to think about peripheries as a crucial part of the whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you mentioned, constitutive of most of the whole, right? Peripheries are actually most
Absolutely.
Of the empire, and so are essential for study as well, and to use your analysis to study other parts of the empire as well. So smuggling is one of the many difficult topics to research, and I kind of go through the struggle as well in my research in the early modern period, because, for the most part, smugglers very rashly did a good job of trying to hide their illegal activity. So did you find it hard to locate sources for this book because of that problem? Or was smuggling such an endemic part of the culture of Hispaniola that practitioners didn't need to hide their actions as much as, say, other times and places?
Smuggling is always difficult. And the good thing about smuggling, I'm gonna turn it actually in a positive, which is, you know, smuggling is fascinating because even though you might find very few times, right, but very few proofs of smuggling, if you find them, it means that it's only the tip of the iceberg, right? But those are the people who got caught. There is a lot of people who didn't get caught. So that you know that actually those small cases, they give you kind of like a template to understand that it's going much deeper, right? But sources for Hispaniola are really challenging, in part because unlike other places in Spanish America, there are very few local sources. So the archives of the Audiencia, for example, all the documents of all the cases that the Audiencia saw, that it doesn't exist. For the 17th century, certainly doesn't exist, and not for the 16th century either. We don't have notaries, the notary archives for Santo Domingo, and we know that there were like 3, 4, 5 notaries at any time, at any given time. We don't have any evidence of those that haven't been preserved. So all we have in many ways are the documents that are is the documents that are in the Archivo de Indias in Sevilla, right? There is a little bit, obviously, in other places. I went to Simancas, also Archivo General de Simancas. So there are a few things there, and then other places, right? But in reality, everything is in the Archivo de Indias. And the contents for Hispaniola for this period are not actually described. So it's a deep dive. You just start looking for documents. I was in the archive for 2 years. I'm lucky because I'm from Sevilla. So I was at home. So I was there for 2 years and I gathered over almost 4,000 documents during this time. But not everybody can do that. And as everybody who works in Spanish America knows, the Archivo de Indias is renowned for having a terrible, terrible copy of documents. The policy for copying documents is awful. So it is really challenging to actually find documents, and it requires like a needle in the haystack process of looking at every paper and kind of turn until you find your body of evidence. It's really hard.
Yeah, I can relate to the problems there of not being able to take photos in the Archivo de Indias, and so you really have to spend a lot of good time there and copy everything that you can there. I think also you mentioned in your book that one of your advisors or professors told you to not study this topic because none of the documents exist anymore because they're all were destroyed or based on weather problems in the Caribbean and organizational problems in the Caribbean.
I can tell listeners that it's challenging, but it's not impossible. So there is in the Archivo de India it's like a bottomless pit of wonderful stuff. Yeah. But you have to find it. That's the problem, right?
Yeah.
We can do a lot about places. It would really, comparatively, at least with places like, I don't know, like Oaxaca or the Andes, mm-hmm. comparatively, they have so much, much richer, like local archives than the Caribbean. But, there is a lot for us to do, people who like the Caribbean, but it's a deep dive.
Definitely. So going into the content of your chapters now, can you talk a little bit about the effects that Sir Francis Drake's sack of the city of Santo Domingo in 1586 had on this economic situation of the island that you were describing previously?
Yeah, I use Francis Drake's attack almost kind of like a rhetorical kind of point in the argument of the book, but I think it does have like real implications, right? I think when you look at the Francis Drake sacked the city for like, I think, a couple of weeks and destroy it burned like a third of the city. It sacked every building. They used, the cathedral in some despicable ways, according to the sources. So I think it had a real shock effect. So in many ways, the Francis Drake sack of the city is kind of like, it's the point in which people in Hispaniola cannot pretend anymore that they're in trouble, right? So at least until then, they, many of them had inherited, particularly, the wealthier people had inherited houses from their forefathers, like stone houses, and they have like silver and gold, and they have goods, and they have, so there is like a material culture that allow them to live in a certain that allow them to live or pretend that actually they were still an important place in the world. I think the sack of Santo Domingo by Drake is going to put an end to that. I think it serves as if before they were actually smuggling, after Francis Drake, I think the importance of smuggling becomes even higher, and the need for smuggling to actually get the goods that they want and need is going to become much higher. And you can see that, but the irony is that you don't see that exclusively in Santo Domingo, people from Santo Domingo, although you do have evidence of that, but it's really across the island. People really step it up when it comes to trading with foreigners in the aftermath of Drake. And also because there are new players after Drake, in many ways represent, after Drake, a lot of Englishmen also come to the Caribbean to trade and to steal, because in many ways the pirate and the smuggler in the 16th and 17th century, these are interchangeable roles, right? It depends on opportunity. If you have opportunity to steal, you steal, and if you don't, then you trade, right? So in many ways the English come in force after Drake's, inspired by Drake, with mixed desires really, and then the Dutch as well. Also very interested in trade as well, the Dutch, in the first decades of the 17th century. So there is an increase of smuggling, I think, after Drake. That is quite important. Yeah.
So why were Spanish officials then unable to curb this growing contraband trade in Hispaniola that develops in this late 16th century?
For at least two reasons. One is that that moral economy was solidified at this time, and people who lived in the far towns and villages of Hispaniola in the north and west, this was the bread. Yeah, this is what the bread and butter. This is what actually made them who they were, right? It gives them the material wealth to then actually be who they were. So there was no will to actually end the system. The system became a way for some people to make money. So the Audiencia names a judge with a cushy salary, and he brings somebody to kind of keep track to write the documentation. He brings an alguacil or a sheriff to actually go with him and then they go there and they start actually basically negotiating with the smugglers, right? So what do you give me if I don't actually arrest you? What do you give me? So there is all this kind of negotiations that you can see sometimes in accusations. People are accusing each other of doing this stuff. And so you can see it becomes a business. The entire process for people of the Audiencia and people who are on the island on Santo Domingo, in the centers of power, it becomes a way to make a living. And many people in Santo Domingo are also involved in the contraband trade. So even though in Spain and in Madrid, the crown wants to stifle this and end the trade, in the island there is no interest. And even when there is interest among some people, they are, in many ways, they are alone. They don't have the power to kind of like do anything about it.
Yeah. So you then tell a story about how sort of in desperation during this circumstance, Spanish authorities see this smuggling and also see that what they consider what you say is sort of Protestant contamination of the island, because so much of this trade is happening with Northern Europeans, Protestant Europeans. So the Spanish authorities decide to launch a violent process of what you call a depopulations of Western and Northern Hispaniola from 1604 to 1606. So can you describe a little bit about what these depopulations were and the importance they had for Hispaniola's history?
Yes, I call them depopulations. There are popularly known as devastaciones, which I try to kind of like walk away from it because it has also certain kind of like nationalistic undertones in Dominican Republic. So I try to kind of move away from that term. To me, it's kind of like it's a depopulation. It's a forced depopulation of the island, and it was very violent. It became violent because there was a great resistance to it. Right. And some people actually raised arm against the governor to stop it. Right. So the depopulation was an attempt after 20 years of the crown trying to end the smuggling and the contraband trade. They have grown increasingly concerned not only about the fact that these people were breaking the Spanish monopoly on goods. I think that's been the traditional interpretation of the depopulation, that it was, to stop contraband. And that was actually very important. But there is also, I think, a religious element that has been forgotten. And that is that there are more and more testimonies going back to Spain that actually these people are entering into long-term agreements with French and English merchants, right? And many of these are seen to be Lutheran, which means basically they are Protestants, right? So, and they are having parties together. They are becoming godparents to children born in the island. So there are, the ties are being solidified, and the crown gets very worried about what that means for kind of like the spiritual purity of Hispaniola and its people. So I think it is precisely at the change of guard in the Consejo de Indias, right? When after Philip II died and Philip III comes to power, it is during those first years that there is a kind of a change of mindset, and they said this decision that, you know, we need to do something drastic about Hispaniola. And then the orders, which the idea actually comes from somebody in Santo Domingo who actually went to, he's the one who gives the idea to do this, and the crown is going to actually take it on and then give the order to the populate to basically burn all the cities and towns in the north and west of the island and move the population to the surroundings of Santo Domingo, right? And they're going to draw a line that people wouldn't be able to cross by penalty of death, really. So but the population, basically the entire island gets depopulated and everybody gets concentrated in kind of a third of the island's land, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really fascinating part of Hispaniola's history, and one that obviously has repercussions as we go forward, which we will talk about. So after these depopulations, you state that, quote, contraband went through a second renaissance centered not in faraway beaches in the north, but in Santo Domingo itself, the city of Santo Domingo itself. That's a quote from page 171. So how did the city of Santo Domingo become a smuggling?
Yeah, it was so several things happened to allow this to happen, right? Well, first of all, the population put everybody around Santo Domingo, right? So the line drawn on the map saying that you cannot cross at this point became kind of it was quite serious. So people who looked for people searched for alternatives, right? And it is around this time also that the legislation around the positions of regidores or councilmen in the city of Santo Domingo are going to change, and the crown is going to start selling them and a perpetuity. So it was selling to you, and then you can actually transfer it to whomever you want, paying only a fraction of what the position cost at the time, right? So this is something that is going to allow a lot of individuals to kind of become part of this kind of like local institutional elite. And they're going to actually use that in order to influence every institution and official on the island. So Santo Domingo is going to become the center of the contraband trade. There's going to be not only Santo Domingo becomes the center of the trade, but actually because there is a continuous lack of cash, people in Santo Domingo, these individuals who are influencing both the Audiencia, the governor, the religious institutions, they're going to start using actually the funds that the crown institutions have, like the situado, which is the money that the crown sends yearly to pay for the administration. They start actually getting their hands on the situado and use it to actually buy goods in other parts of the Caribbean, right? So it becomes a huge business. Not only they're influencing the Audiencia, so certain individuals are become kind of go-betweens with people in north coast of Venezuela, Cuba, all those people who have cases to appeal. They actually go, they don't go straight to the Audiencia. They go to some of these local leaders who then negotiate with the people of the Audiencia. So they give them powers. So this becomes a business. And then the money of the situado becomes actually like a cash cow for a lot of people to use and to enrich themselves. To the detriment, of course, mostly of the soldiers. The soldiers are going to suffer tremendously because of this.
Yeah, I don't want to talk too much about this because I want to give our listeners an incentive to actually buy the book. But your description of one of these characters, Rodrigo Pimentel, is absolutely fascinating. I didn't know about him before I read this book, but he seems to be the sort of almost de facto leader of Santo Domingo. At this time, he is, you know, a private citizen, but has immense control and acting with impunity. And as you said, you know, using the situado, this royal treasury, to help buy contraband goods, you know, under the nose and with the consent of the governor. And, you know, it almost, I'm not sure if this is an apt comparison, but it almost reminded me of sort of a Pablo Escobar type figure of the 17th century, you know, of kind of controlling and doing extra legal control over this region. It's a really, really fascinating character that you really bring to life really well in this book.
He really is. Yeah. It's a riot to actually see. This is one of those cases in which, reality in many ways surpasses fiction. What this guy was able to do in the time that he was alive, and he became extraordinarily wealthy. His fortune was calculated in between 300,000 and 400,000 pesos. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for the time. So this guy had so much money and so much influence, and it changed, right? The interesting thing is it's not a linear growth constantly, but there are actually ups and downs in the process, right? So it's definitely worth. That's probably one of my favorite chapters because it's the one that allows me to really kind of tell like a story of a character that really illuminates what is happening, as a whole in Santo Domingo.
Yeah. It's really, the episode you have of the graffiti on the walls of Santo Domingo, the prime mover of all machinations, there's so much respect respect is not the right word for
fear. Respect and fear, right.
But yeah, fear of him. It's a really fascinating episode there. So the island of Hispaniola, for those of you who have some sense of geography, now constitutes the two nation states of Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which in the early modern period roughly corresponded to the colonies that were known as Saint-Domingue and Santo Domingo. So the history of this island also involves French colonization and population of the western third of this island beginning in the 17th century. So what was the relationship between the Spanish residents on the eastern side and those of this new colony of Saint-Domingue?
Yeah, that relationship is going to evolve, right? We know that, this is in the beginnings, the colonization of the Northern European colonization of Western Hispaniola was kind of, this is the time of the buccaneers, right? 1630s onwards from the island of Tortuga, which is in the northwest corner of Hispaniola. So in the beginning, it's quite fraught, right? I mean, there are several expeditions to expel, successful expeditions actually, to expel those Northern Europeans, English and French. They were kind of like a mixed crew of people who were residing, their stronghold was Tortuga. So there are several expeditions to expel them, but they're never gonna go away completely. They always come back because the Spaniards go back to Santo Domingo and then they move back, right? So this is a time of the buccaneers in which you have people roaming the island, hunting for feral cattle, and planting tobacco. There are relationships between this buccaneer sometimes and maroon groups that are living together even sometimes. This is an aspect that is very hard to document, really. I think the French sources have more on this. But once by 1670s, really the French are already in control of this colony, of this side of Tortuga particularly, and they start actually populating the north of the island, and they start actually spreading through the west, from the northwest of the island. And by then, it becomes very, there is a fight for territory. By then, Hispaniola or Santo Domingo started kind of like move away from the populations quite a lot and started actually create settlements again in this frontier area, because they are realizing that the French are expanding and they need to claim as much territory as possible. So there is the frontier for the Spanish is moving westwards, the frontier for the French is moving eastwards, and that's going to actually produce quite a lot of conflict, a lot of skirmishes. By the 1680s, there is actually a moment of peace between France and Spain. And I think this is a moment in which the commercial contacts between both sides, they start. And it become quite fluid. It becomes, this is the foundational moment in which Santo Domingo is going to start providing Saint-Domingue or what it's going to be Saint-Domingue with cattle, that is going to become crucial to actually develop the sugar economy and the slave-driven economy that they're going to actually be famous for in the 18th century. In many ways, every Barbados needs a Carolina, and every Saint-Domingue needs Santo Domingo, right? I mean, in many ways, the fact that Santo Domingo, the source of food, is so close to Saint-Domingue, in many ways explain why Saint-Domingue was able to produce that amount of sugar and coffee and dedicate their best land just to produce these cash crops, because the food was coming from across the border. So there was a constant flow throughout the 18th century. But that this is the foundational moment of this. It is actually in the last decades of the 17th century.
Yeah, I think that's really a really fine, I want to put a fine point on that, because, you know, in my research too, in the 18th century, you see this cattle trade increase and in mule trade as well. So providing the food and you know, livestock and labor in terms of animals to really fuel these sugar mills. And so, you know, you can see, and a lot of historiography has gone with this, you talk about Carolina and Barbados, but, you know, New England and the cod fishery and Jamaica and other places in the colonial Caribbean and these sort of foundations, these supports for these sugar economies, and how much other places were wrapped up in this sugar economy. It's not just the prime sugar plantations, those colonies, but it's really a full network that are supporting these, which is a really important point.
And it's really interesting that, you know, obviously the crown is opposed to this trade in the very early on. By the 18th century, it's going to become regulated because there is money to be made. But in the 17th century, late 17th century, it's actually forbidden. But at the same time, they cannot completely go against the people who are participating, because these people are holding the line. Mm-hmm. Almost literally against the French, right? So while sometimes there are skirmishes against the French, in other times they're trading with the French. So this living in this frontier region becomes kind of really interesting, in which, you know, that there are moments of conflict, that there are also moments of peaceful collaboration, right? At this time, at least.
Yeah, with the Spanish having the difficult situation of not wanting Saint-Domingue to expand too much, but also wanting to support them because it's profitable to do so.
Right? I mean, the crown is going to be very invested in, by the way, by the 1690s, very invested in kicking out the French, and they're going to try in a couple of occasions, but they're gonna fail, in part because local people in Hispaniola, from Santiago particularly, in the north of the island, they're going to oppose this, and they're going to sabotage the military expeditions to expel the French, because by that point that trade is so important for everybody that expelling the French is not a solution, particularly when the Spanish crown hasn't done anything to fix that commercial gap, you know, that exists in Santo Domingo.
Yeah, so kind of a related question here. We've spoken a lot about elites and their smuggling practices and quests for local wealth and control. But kind of talking about enslaved Africans, what role did this group, enslaved Africans, play in this process of the early colonial history of Santo Domingo?
Yeah, enslaved Africans are a crucial part of the entire contraband trade in many ways. But they're also caught in a very difficult situation, right? They are forced to collaborate with their owners in their schemes for power and influence, and for in smuggling contacts. But at the same time, they are trying, and sometimes are complying with those wishes, in part to kind of improve their situation, gain the confidence of their owners, with the ultimate goal of really attaining their freedom, right? So there is, in many ways, enslaved Africans are caught between those, you know, that they are doing something that is clearly illegal, and they could actually get in trouble with the Spanish administrators. But at the same time, their owners are forcing them to participate in this trade, right? So there is, they are occupying this kind of very conflicted middle ground, right? And sometimes they're doing the bidding of their masters, because there is something for them to be gained. You know, they're willing participators, because for them, they think that they are gaining something. Or are, so there are some examples in the book. Enslaved Africans, for example, in the early 1580s, before the depopulations, enslaved Africans were in charge of, actually, in many cases, loading and collecting kind of like the goods that were going to be traded. So they are the ones, it's not their masters or the owners, actually the ones who are doing this. They are kind of crisscrossing the island through the different properties and taking the goods and taking them to the coast. So that probably gave them a small amount of independence, I guess, you know, they can move around quite freely, which is something that you also find, I think, in rural properties. There is all these cattle ranches allowed for actually a different form of slavery that is kind of semi-autonomous to a certain degree, right? After the depopulations, particularly for those who actually live in Santo Domingo, in this kind of struggles for power, you're going to see enslaved people participating in assassination attempts between different members of the elite, and this is something that I talk about. And so to me, in many ways, slavery becomes another part of this kind of struggle for power, right? So it's not only slavery becomes a tool for power in the hands of it's part of the technology of power that in many ways slave owners are using for their own ends, right? But always, I always start to kind of go back to this idea that enslaved Africans, they have their own agenda when doing this, right? And in the several examples that I have in the book, I try very hard to kind of try to see what do they have to gain in this process, right? And why they're doing what they're doing, right? I think by the end of the 17th century, throughout the island, there are, you know, enslaved Africans are again kind of participating in this trade with Saint-Domingue. They're very much active in the deals of their owners. And you can see that. And I think that might have given them a modicum amount of independence. I think they're always hoping, to a certain degree, they're hoping to gain the trust of the owner and to work, collaborate with them with the ultimate goal of getting their freedom, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, it's a fine line to walk, and you walk it well in the book of talking about how these enslaved Africans are used by, their enslavers, but also have their own agenda. And even though that agenda is sometimes hard and those experiences or perspectives are hard to get at, you can do some reading against the grain to figure out what their perspective is as well too. Yeah. So overall then, you know, with this talking about Hispaniola in this long 17th century, would it be fair to say, in your opinion, that this colony wasn't really quote unquote Spanish at this time period?
This is a good question. I think in some ways, it was actually the opposite. It was very much a Spanish colony, but that becoming being Spanish and it was not due to kind of historical inertia, right? Either by design or by flaw. In the case of Hispaniola, I think local people worked very hard to kind of gain a certain modicum of independence from the Spanish Empire while using the tools of the Spanish Empire put at their disposal, right? So in many ways, being Spanish or actually be under the umbrella of the Spanish Empire afforded people in Hispaniola a wider margin of movement than any other situation. So I think in this case, and I think probably in many cases, some places kind of in the periphery, it's not only just the fact that they are loyal to their king. There is more of that, right? In this case, I think in many ways that independence they have reinforced Hispaniola's loyalty to the crown, and not the opposite, right? Which is kind of it might seem counterintuitive, but it's I think precisely places like this one, they become more Spanish and not less, precisely because of their kind of being surrounded also by Northern Europeans. Probably that also reinforced that Spanishness, at least among certain groups.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating that point you say about how this, you know, in the English context, it's called salutary neglect or benign neglect, or in the obedesco pero no cumplo kind of doctrine of, you know, obeying and having nominal and perhaps, you know, actual true allegiance to the crown of Spain, but you know, having that allegiance because of that kind of being left alone to do your own thing. It's really interesting because I was talking to a scholar at a conference named Dr. Evan Hafley, who kind of commented how, in his mind, there are some, and I'm not accusing you of this at all, but there are some people who write about smuggling from a more nationalist perspective and say, you know, look at this, you know, in the colonial period, whatever Latin America country they're talking about, we survived, we did it on our own. And kind of having that sort of independent streak of working outside of the Spanish Empire. But it's, I just think it's really interesting how these two things can perhaps, or a grain of truth can be true for both of those, that there is some sort of autonomy and independent character being formed through this process of smuggling, but at the same time also a greater allegiance to the Spanish for sort of allowing that and being under this sort of benign system as well.
Yeah. And, you know, in the case of Hispaniola, the interesting thing is that they had their chance to actually kind of walk away from Spain in 1655 with the English attack, right, the island. So they could have, in some ways, you think they might have been able to, you know, if Santo Domingo had fallen, then the story would be very different. But they actually, you know, they really routed the English, you know, they really pushed back. So that must, I think there is a reason for that. I don't think there is only historical kind of inertia of, you know, I'm Spanish and I'm always going to be Spanish. I think there is, to a certain degree, conscious or unconscious, there is a process here that we need to consider.
Yeah, and there's a real consciousness, and the history of Jamaica would be a lot different too if the English had conquered Santo Domingo rather than going in the Consolation Prize of Jamaica in 1655.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed.
So, as a sort of final question about this book, what do you want readers to most take away from this work of yours?
Oof. Wow, goodness, there's a lot, right?
Of course.
I don't know. I'm still baffled by how little work there is in the 17th century. I think to gaining a new appreciation for the 17th century in general, which is kind of like the forgotten century when it comes to the colonial period, at least for the Spanish, there is very little work on it. So gaining appreciation of those territories that are being traditionally seen as peripheries and understand that they actually fulfill a very important role within the whole of the Spanish Empire, that'll be some of it. Gaining some understanding of the place that Hispaniola occupies in this kind of like wider Spanish Caribbean and Spanish Atlantic, I think that would be also very, very useful. So I will probably go with that.
Sounds good. Well, there's a lot to take away from this book, so that's probably an unfair question there. as a sort of final question, we like to ask all our guests here, are there any projects on the horizon for you, any publications that you want to alert us to?
Well, I'm working now on an article for a special number that Ida Allman and David Witt are putting together for Colonial Latin American Review. So it's actually about an episode in Santo Domingo that happened in the 1680s. And it involves actually Rodrigo Pimentel actually features quite prominently in it. But it's basically it's what happened actually before the fall of Veracruz. The fall of Veracruz in some ways was provoked by some events that actually happened in Santo Domingo in the 1680s. So I'm finishing that article right now. And then I'm working on a translation and critical edition of the travels of a gentleman called Gregorio de Robles, who is an individual who actually traveled through all the Atlantic in the 1680s, 1690s. He'd crossed as a soldier in San Agustin and then was able to kind of like get discharged. And he traveled everywhere in the Caribbean. He went to the Andes. He went to Tierra de Fuego, to like Argentina. He went to Africa. He was taken prisoner. So, and he goes everywhere describing what he sees and talking, giving advice to the crown about what they could do in different places and encountering contraband trade everywhere he goes. So I think it would be a really useful, there are not that many voices for the late 17th century, nor not many Spanish voices for that period. So I think this would be a nice addition to put it out there. And then the biggest project, I guess, that I have in hand now, I'm trying to kind of put together a project around enslaved Afrika for descendants in the insular Spanish Caribbean, right, throughout the 17th century. So looking at Eastern Cuba, Hispaniola, Puerto Rico, and Jamaica before 1655. But I don't know where that is going. I'm just starting with that one. It's really, really big. So we'll see.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing those works in print sometime in the future.
Thank you.
Dr. Ponce Vasquez, many thanks for your time in this really, really great conversation.
Thank you, Grant. Thank you. Thank you a lot.
Yeah. So Islanders and Empire, Smuggling and Political Defiance in Hispaniola, 1580 to 1690 is out now via Cambridge University Press. For the New Books Network, this is R. Grant Clauser saying thank you and see you next time.